At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Today, we are going back into one of the most baffling cases in recent memory. The suspicious death of Ellen Greenberg. And we're going to keep digging into this case because it deserves being dug into. Despite lots of people being silenced about this case, more has happened in the last, I would say, 72 to 48 hours as of this recording than has happened in the last 14 years because of the persistence and because of a parent's love for their daughter and seeking justice. For over a decade, the official ruling of suicide has defied logic, and we were just supposed to sit and go, oh, if you say that's true, it must be true. She turned into a zombie and stabbed herself after she died. That's essentially what the story is. Now, after relentless efforts by Ellen's family, a major shift has finally taken place. The very medical examiner who initially ruled her death a suicide has reversed her decision, stating the manner of death should be something other than suicide. With us today is retired FBI Special Agent Robin Drake, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, to help break down the behavioral anomalies, investigative missteps, and possible motives behind the actions or inactions of those who've long defended the ruling. Let's start out here. When you look at the official handling of this case, Robin, from the initial police response to the medical examiner's ruling that seemingly was locked in for 14 years despite the overwhelming forensic inconsistencies and the fact that originally was homicide and then changed to suicide, and now they're saying, no, this is something other than suicide. What jumps out at you as in terms of investigative red flags in this whole catastrophe that is the case of Ellen Greenberg?
You know, every investigator has a kind of a different methodology for going about looking at things that go sideways, right? And mine as a behavior guy is I'm always looking at behaviors. I'm looking at patterns. I'm looking at patterns of the victim. I'm looking at patterns of potential bad guys. I'm looking at patterns of organizations, institutions. I'm always looking for patterns because patterns give us probabilities. And when we see a deviation from what we expect to have happen, that's when we kind of zero in on that and say, what happened here? Because that is a data point that says we have something sideways, and something sideways there most likely is where we go and investigate. And in this case, we had so many things that were low probability of what actually happened that it makes no sense, like you were saying. So let's look at suicide first. All right. So we have a young woman that they said committed suicide after they said it was murder. Now they went back to suicide. Mm-hmm. And it was suicide by knife stabbing. So next thing what we do is, as an investigator, is we look at what's the probability, how often does someone commit suicide by self-inflicted wound of knife stabbing? That's extremely low. I think when I looked at it, it's like less than 5% of the people. And then I look at, you know, as they're claiming it was, what, 22 self-inflicted stab wounds? Is high number of self-inflicted stab wounds. And then so I'm looking at that number, and then I'm looking at the location. Back of the neck. So the neck, when you're actually as a place, they don't even have a stat on the back of the neck. They have it for the front of the neck where the carotid artery is. That is the least likely place that someone actually kills himself as well. So in other words, we have data points of highly unlikely, and just highly unlikely. So the probability of all these things lining up and being true, highly unlikely. So why an investigator? So now we look at the other side. Why would an investigator keep investigating down that line? Because there must be an outside influence that we're unaware of. And that's the only conclusion you can come to.
I mean, the problem with this case is there's no investigation. It was, they just they ruled it a suicide. I mean, there's so many things that make no sense in this case.
Nope.
The knife never fingerprinted. The door, nothing was fingerprinted. Nothing was checked for DNA. Nothing was looked at in terms of this being a crime scene or a murder scene. They just immediately labeled this thing a suicide. Now, even in cases where it looks like it might be a suicide, let's say somebody's hanging from their closet or whatever things, there's a gunshot wound to the head, and it looks like this is likely a suicide, they still look into it a bit just to kind of make sure this is what it looks like. This looked nothing like a suicide. So how did they go from this just walking in going, oh, suicide? That to me is just the most baffling part of this case. And, you know, how did they get there? Why did they get there? It doesn't seem to be a logical path for anyone to have ever gone down.
Well, because the logical path would be that you would not investigate it or state it was a suicide. So the only thing you can conclude is that someone didn't want it investigated as a murder. And so then we have to look at, well, what people are in this person's life? Because if there's, again, when we look at stats, the probability that when there's a murder or even assault that takes place, that person that's been assaulted or murdered knows the person, I think it's like 95, we said this on multiple episodes, you know, I think it's like 95% of the people that are murdered or assaulted are assaulted by someone that they know in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're looking at law stats, someone did not want to investigate it as a murder, the likelihood and probability of the potential person is 95% of that person is probably in their life already. So what they should have done is investigated as a potential murder. And the first thing you do is you look at the people in her life that there's an unhealthy relationship with, because then we're going to have a pattern of behavior most likely escalating in unhealthy to violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got a couple ideas on that, but yeah. There's other breaking news on this. In the last, like I said, in the last week or so of reporting on this, we have the medical examiner that has walked back their story, and there's another person who has come out and said, mm-mm, that is not what happened. A key piece to this story, to an alibi of this story. And we'll talk about that part in just a moment. I want to go back to the medical examiner, though. And why now? Why, after all of these years, 14 years later, would this medical examiner decide to stand up and say, you know what? I think I was wrong.
Look, I become a stat guy on these kind of things because stats are probabilities of human behavior.
Yeah.
I looked at this too. What's the probability and likelihood that a medical examiner reverses their decision? It's also extremely low. And the things that will compel a medical examiner to switch their opinion is new evidence, public outcries, public opinions, investigations. You know, so there's other, in other words, there's outside influences. You know, human beings as a species, we are not very good at self-correcting behaviors. Because once we lock into something, we will double down on that belief system wholeheartedly, because to do anything else would say, I was wrong. And boy, we do not like admitting that we're wrong unless compelled by some sort of outside influence. And so in this case, there was some outside pressure that most likely inspired the medical examiner to reverse the decision. And because it took so long to do, you know, there was either an amazing self reflective event in their life at this point in time, or there's an outside pressure and influence that came in and said, you're compelled to for this reason.
I really wonder what that is, because if you go back 14 years, it seems a lot of these people were compelled to not go along with reality. And now they're compelled to say more so dealing with reality on reality's terms. Simply, she didn't become a zombie and stab herself again. There's post-mortem stab wounds on her. How does that even happen? How does that even get into a report? How does that not somewhere along the chain of command, somebody goes, post-mortem stab wounds and it's a suicide? I think you better go back and re-examine this. But nobody did that. How? How does that It seems like it shouldn't even like make the, it doesn't make the smell test at the basic, most basic of levels.
There's a lot of different ways that could happen. You know, I wish I could give it, it's because of this. And it could be an overworked system where you have a lot of individuals, where you have like only a couple investigators available and they've got a caseload like this high. And this is low, you know, low on their radar because it was, they were told, you know, like think about, so let's do our thought experiment. You have a supervisor that's overseeing a squad of people. Low number of people, they have a caseload like this, people that execute the case like this, they get a report in that there's been a death and that the medical examiner's office ruled suicide. They said, fine, done, suicide, move on. They're not looking at details, they're looking at moving on to the next problem because they made it easy for them to move on to the next problem. Because remember, that is what human beings typically do when they want to influence and persuade people to an action. They make it easy for them to take that action. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that, yeah, it's a big cabal. You know, everyone's in on it. They're protecting someone and they don't want it to come out in true light. That's another possibility. There's always a lot of possibilities that come in here, but when there's smoke, there's going to be fire somewhere, and that's what they should be doing right now is investigating. All right, this doesn't make any sense. It passes zero smell test on a lot of levels, both behaviorally, investigatively, and now we just have to see where the chips fall. But you're right. Why now? Why all these people? And I think because the – and I'll give a lot of – all the credit in the world to the family.
Yeah.
Family, they know their daughter, and a lot of people say, my daughter or my child would never do this. Well – there's no pattern of behavior that she would have.
No, it's just been said, she was suffering. She had some mental health issues going on. She was taking this. Okay, great. I understand that. I understand suicide. But this was not a suicide. So if it was a suicide, case closed. Okay, bad place, made a bad decision, and that's the end of it. She didn't. That's not what happened. That's just the thing. And I'm not saying who did this to her. I have no idea who did this to her. There's certainly people that should be answering some questions and should be looked into. It's very bizarre behavior to suddenly, you know, not care about investigating the death of someone you are very, very close to and just kind of walk away going, oh, I accept that, even though it's the most bizarre story in the world. But I don't know, people have weird reactions to things. A key piece of information has also come down just in the last 24 hours of this recording. News Nation is reporting from Brian Enten that the doorman who has long been said, I believe in reports, that he had gone up to the door to break it down with the ex-fiance or watched the ex-fiance do that. Big part of this alibi of... well, the doorman saw me do it. Apparently nobody looked into that part either, which I'm not really that surprised by, considering they didn't look into the knife, the prints on the knife, or the fact that she stabbed herself after she died. So I guess the doorman's not a far cry, but I was really kind of surprised to hear this. Brian Enten was reporting on News Nation that he talked to the doorman, and essentially the doorman has said, I was not there when that door got broken down. That is not accurate. So the story that there was someone watching this door be broken down, apparently not true, according to that new reporting by News Nation. And if you just look at the door, if you look at the crime scene photos that exist of the door, the way the latch works, it doesn't look all broken down, quite honestly. You'd have like wood ripped out of the wall and the frame, because the story has always been this door was locked on the inside. How could this possibly have been this way if it was locked from the inside? Well, it doesn't really look all that broken down. And the man who says that, or who originally was claimed to have been there by a third party, says he was never there. So kind of another big piece that kind of makes you go,
yeah, things that make you go, you know. Another aspect of this that I'd be looking at is, so we have things that don't add up on this one case. And as an investigator, the other thing I'd be looking at in hindsight is, do we have an organizational issue or do we have an individual issue? Because sometimes, as we're seeing in the Boston case with Karen Reed, we got a lot of data points saying we got an organizational issue because there's other cases that have been that are really, really weird and sideways during a time period of that organization institution. So we might have an organizational issue at hand here that needs investigating, or it might have just been one bad cop. In this case, I would do the same thing. So I would look at this time period in which this happened, that they claim that she was, that it was a suicide. I'd look at other cases and other things that happened in that time period in that department to see if other things aren't adding up as well.
Mm-hmm.
If everything's adding up fine, then this is a case of an individual with an issue or an individual potential cover up or shifting of the narrative as opposed to organizational. So that's what I'd also be looking at.
I mean, the list goes on and on about all the bizarre things in this case that just make no sense. We can go over them, I think, till we're blue in the face. Have you heard the 911 call?
No, I haven't heard the 911 call on this one, but yes, 911 calls are extremely telling.
Well, you're in for a treat, Robin, because we're going to listen to a good chunk of the 911 call. And I want to just, you know, I want to get your live reaction as we play it back. We'll probably pause a few times in here as we break it down. But yeah, let's take a listen to the 911 call. This is the ex-fiance. This is Sam Goldman calling 911. As he discovers, supposedly, you know, his fiance dead. I want to make note of something before we even go into it, though, because this is this, I think, is key. Just for reference, as you're going into this, it sounds as if he is discovering what has happened to Ellen as the call is progressing. But he enters into the call acting as if he already has the knowledge. That's a weird part. I noticed that in the, I made that observation this last week while listening to it for like the 40th time. Let's take a listen. Here's a 911 call.
Oh, I need a emergency now. I just walked into my apartment. My fiance's on the floor with blood everywhere.
What is the address?
4601 Flat Rock Road. Please come. Help.
4601
Flat Rock Road.
Is this a house or apartment?
Oh, no. Oh, no. It's an apartment.
What apartment number?
Please hurry, please.
Where is she bleeding from?
I don't know. I can't tell.
So you have to calm yourself down in order to get you some help.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm looking at her right now. I can't see anything. There's nothing broken. She's bleeding. Ellie!
You don't know where she's bleeding from? Can't see where the blood's coming from?
I think her head. I think she hit her head, I think. But it's up everywhere. It's everywhere.
She might have fallen. Do you know what happened?
She may have slipped. There's blood on the table. Her face is a little purple.
Okay, hold on for rescue for her. Stay on the phone.
Fire Department
842,
what's the address?
4601 Flat Rock Road, please hurry.
4601 Flat Rock?
Yes.
What's wrong?
I went downstairs to go work out. I came back up, the door was latched. My fiance's inside, she wasn't answering, so after about a half hour, I decided to break it down. I see her now just on the floor with blood. She's not responding.
Okay, is she breathing? Look at her chest. I need you to calm down, and I need you to look at her chest. It's really.
I don't think she is.
Listen to me. Someone's on the way. Look at her chest. Is she flat on her back?
She's on her back.
Look at her chest and tell me if it's going up and down, up and down.
I don't see her moving.
Okay, do you know how to do CPR?
I don't.
Okay, I can tell you what to do, okay, until they get there. I want you to keep her foot.
Oh,
on her.
God.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, okay.
Are you willing to do CPR with me over the phone until they get there?
I have to, right?
I'm going to pause right there. We're going to go back to more of it.
God, I have to.
I suppose, right? I have to, right?
There's a lot of red flags.
Let's just begin with that first part because there's so much and there's a whole second half here. Give me your reactions.
So anytime you're dealing with anything like this in anything in life, we do that deep act of empathy where we put ourselves in that person's place and try to imagine what your response would be for someone you love dearly like this. And then you kind of look at what you would react like, and then you kind of try to superimpose it on what you're actually hearing from someone else. The amount of detail that sounded very scripted to me right at the beginning was my first red flag that I wouldn't typically hear that. You would hear someone that was not believing what they're seeing and get here now. I don't know what's wrong. Oh my God, I need help. You know, it's just like that. And then what the 911 caller is trying to do is calm them down to get details. He gave details before he was asked. So that this rings to me of scripting, because people don't want to believe what they're seeing because they're not expecting to see it. And so that's what was a little off to me at the very beginning.
Some of the things that I had noted in there, the scriptedness, it feels of it, the alibi that is talked about immediately.
The focus also was leaving her onto him, and part of the script was he scripted in his alibi of how he found her.
Yeah.
That's not what you care about.
At that moment, no.
No, nope, 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 nope. Your mind is not thinking that. If this was about her, it wouldn't be. And what we kept seeing, the data points, or he kept shifting it back to him, including him. The other thing, and I'm sorry to interject this too, the other first thing that you do when you show up on scene that hopefully that the people that show up, the first responders, would see was, is there blood on him?
Mm-hmm.
Because because a lot of indicators are when first responders show on scene and the person called in the 911 call for a loved one that is, as he described, bloody, the first thing you should see is blood all over the person trying to save their life.
Yeah.
I'd be curious.
Yeah, I would too. But again, never investigate it as a crime. I also noticed this, and this has been kind of a tell sign in other 911 calls of it being scripted. And again, these are just observations. I'm not saying he did this. He has never been charged with a crime. He's off living his life in, I believe, New York City. He has a family, has kids, has moved on. And good for him. If he has nothing to do with this, good. I hope that after a trauma like this, and if your way of mourning was really just walking away from this and not doing anything else, okay, that's, people do things. So whatever it may be. But again, questions should be answered. And I'm just saying that. Questions should be answered. But it was weird, if you notice. We go from huffing, puffing the second that there's a connection there on the phone with the dispatcher. And then, hang on, it all stops. The huffing, the puffing. And all of a sudden, it's like, action! Then the second one comes on, and all of a sudden, whoa, we go back into frantic mode. But then very quickly, we go up and down, up and down. Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, is that... I suppose I have to, right? Oh, my God! Again, people can be weird. People can act in strange ways. I don't know. I mean, yes, it could be explained. It could be 1,000% innocent. It just stands out as weird. And that's why it's like, why did we not look at this a little bit closer? Just to get the questions answered.
So I suppose I have to. That line is such a fascinating line. I'd be very curious about how he processes information. And what I mean by that is, I don't know if he was saying that as a question to them, or is he saying it as reflection internally, like his thought processes. I mean, think about this. If you're trying to script something and you forgot a key point, you're saying to yourself, oh, I suppose I have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And at this point, he has not revealed to the 911 operator, and he supposedly hasn't seen this yet. So it's not that he had it supposedly in his knowledge to reveal yet, but he has not yet revealed that there is a knife in her heart specifically. That's coming up next. I think it's an interesting thought of, if you had something to do with this, again, I'm not saying he had anything to do with it, but let's say somebody did have something to do with it, and you know they're already dead, and you know there's a knife in them, and someone says, can you do CPR? You're probably thinking, why would I? Like, this is already, but supposedly at this moment, doesn't know that there's this knife in her, so there's not the immediate reaction of, sure, and so anyway, yeah.
So again, boy, that's really interesting. I have heard this before a while ago, Tony. It's interesting because the first thing you'd be saying, again, place yourself in that moment. Out of all everything that you're described here, as he's painting the picture, he's painting a picture of someone who's bloody on the floor. He has no idea why they're bloody and on the floor, but actually, there's a knife protruding from the chest.
Maybe she hit her head. Maybe she did this. But there's a knife protruding from her chest, and he misses that.
The first thing that came to your mind was, oh, my God, what the F do I do? There's a friggin' knife in her chest. That's exactly what you would say and do. Well, that's when you tell the 911 person, should I pull it out? Do I not pull it out? What do I do?
Well,
that's what you would actually do.
What is the impetus for the 911 call if you're not even over there looking at her yet? Usually, you would go over, well, what the hell is going on? And you see what's going on, and you try to save her if you can, and you get an assessment of the situation quickly. If she's just lying on the ground on the other side of the room, the first reaction is usually not, let's just call 911. It's go over there and see what is going on first.
Right.
But that's not what occurs in this, the way that this plays out on the phone call. Which doesn't make a lot of sense. Again, people react to things differently, and you look and go, how that, why, huh? What were you thinking? I don't know. Again, not saying anything. I'm just saying,
so,
look at the evidence. So, look at the clues. Ask questions.
Again, it's the data points, Tony.
Yeah.
It's like all the data points of the extremely low probability for suicide, extremely low probability for how she committed suicide. Now, again, like you said, don't know. Not saying he did or didn't, but extremely low probability for the 911 call methodology.
Yes, and the 911 call really is what I think gets it for me. Going, there's something.
So you have such low probability on how this whole thing took place, on every single aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's continue on, because there's more on the 911 call. Let's keep playing that. So this is picking up from, I suppose I have to, in terms of doing CPR on his dead fiance.
Okay, so get her flat on her back, bare her chest, okay? You want to rip her shirt off. Okay? Kneel down by her side.
Oh, my God. Allie, please.
Listen, you can't freak out, sir, because you
okay, I'm trying not to. I'm trying not to. Her shirt won't come off. It's a zipper.
Rip
oh, my
off.
God. She stabbed herself.
Where?
She fell in a knife. Oh, no. Her knife's sticking out.
Her what?
There's a knife sticking out of her heart.
Oh, she stabbed herself?
I guess so. I don't know where she fell on it. I don't know.
Okay, well, don't touch it.
Okay, so I just let her down here now? I mean, what do I do?
No, I mean, you can't. If the knife is at her chest, it's going to be kind of hard for you to do CPR at this time.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Police, which operator?
277.
Is someone coming here?
Yes, they are. You said 4601 Flat Rock, right?
Yes.
Okay, someone's on the way. And the knife is still inside?
Which or what?
The knife is still inside of her?
Yes, I didn't take it out.
Was it her chest or what area?
It's in her chest. It looks like it's right in her heart.
Okay, someone's on the way out there, okay? Just get
oh, my God. Oh, my God.
How old is she?
She's 27.
27. And there's no sign of life at all?
No, please don't be. What?
Bend her under her arm and tell me if she responds to pain.
She's... Ellie!
That's the a good chunk of the 911 call right there. Thoughts on the second half?
Just more of the same. Very scripted. Just very scripted. The other thing, too, that's interesting, how do you stab yourself through your rib cage?
I thought the verbiage was really, oh, my God, it's in her heart. It's in her heart. I have a general idea of where my heart is, but I don't think if I saw a stab, I'd be like, it's in the heart. Be like, it's stabbed. It's in their chest. There's a knife in her. There's not in her heart. That I found odd. Again, everybody does things differently, communicates differently. And I also thought it was interesting, the shock that is going through this individual. I don't know. I swear all the time. So the whole damn call would be bleeped if it was me.
Oh,
But there was only like one bleep in there or a few.
Oh, my gosh.
And when it's like it's in her heart. Oh, my goodness.
Gosh.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Like if someone spilled milk. Oh, my goodness. Let's go get a rag and clean that up. Not so, there's blood everywhere and she's been stabbed everywhere.
So the law of probabilities here is really off the charts, because most. Again, suicide by knife is one of the least common, because it's very personal. It's violent. It's painful. It's horrible, right? And when the people do it, they're going for soft tissues. The most common spot where the people stab themselves is the abdomen, because it's soft tissue. It does a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a slow, painful death from it too. The second places is like the legs, the inside of the thighs, the arteries there, major arteries. Same thing. People go for the wrist. Sometimes the jugular on the neck is the least common place. The rib cage? Try to get through a rib cage with a knife.
Try to just like get baby back ribs and just randomly take your knife and get through that. Yeah.
And the pain involved with it too. So things that stop people is pain. You know, I don't care how bad you want to kill yourself. The pain associated with it is it's the most painful thing that you can go through is a stabbing in the chest.
Mm-hmm.
And to self-inflict one, it's extremely rare. Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
And at the end, again, I keep there all of that because there's just it's just like piles and piles of shit over here of like there's this does not look right. As, again, the biggest one to me is just simply. OK, so we need to believe she turned into a zombie and stabbed herself after she died.
Mm-hmm.
That one to me is just like, okay, what more do you need here to know this is not a suicide? Because if we are to believe the official original report, it is that she would have had to have come back from the dead and stabbed herself several times deeply. Again, it's like, what are we... It's like talking to a crazy person when you try to have a conversation with somebody that thinks that this is legitimately a suicide. Fortunately, there's very few people who actually feel that way. But it's it just defies all logic and reality.
Yeah, I know we made this reference once before on another episode when it came to bite wounds and in the Karen Reed case and the dog with Jaws. Mm-hmm. Well, same thing here. If you go back to the movie Jaws, the medical examiner first ruled it a shark attack because of everything they saw. And then the mayor came in and said, oh, we can't say it's a shark attack because it killed tourism, and he reversed it.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical examiner first rules this a murder, a homicide, and then changes his mind.
Yeah.
What compelled him to change his mind? What challenge prior to your pain point to get poked at in him in his life that inspired him to change that to a suicide when nothing in science or in data accumulation in this type of thing supports it?
That's the question. And I'm thinking there might be some people out there that don't want that answered, and it hasn't been answered in 14 years. And maybe there should be a little bit concern very soon because I think that answer may be brought to light.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.